This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. As always, I'm your center, and I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post.
Hey, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
It is the first week of July, and this week we're bringing you a special show for Independence Day. On our country's birthday, we want to check in on how America is doing. Later in the show, we'll be joined by the writer Michael Brendan Doherty. His new book, My Father Left Me Ireland, is a memoir, but it's also an argument about the importance of national identity. We'll talk about his reconnection with Ireland, the country where his father lived as Michael was raised in New York, and what that has to teach us about how Americans can reclaim common bonds with each other. But with us first is Matt Iglesias, senior writer at Vox. Back in October 2015, Matt wrote an essay called American Democracy is Doomed. Matt makes that provocative claim because our system of government is highly unusual for a stable democracy. Most rich and peaceful countries have parliamentary systems, where a party that wins a majority in the legislative election chooses the prime minister who controls the entire government. They don't have to get the minority party to cooperate in implementing a policy agenda. And if there's a crisis where a majority in the legislature can't agree on how to govern, they call a new election and elect a new government. There are clear ways to break through gridlock. Unusually, in America, we have separate elections for a legislature and a powerful executive president. They may be from different parties with very different ideologies, and the legislature and the president have a lot of tools to get in each other's way. In most other countries that have adopted systems similar to ours, it has ended up breaking down in constitutional crisis, where the gridlock becomes untenable and one part of the government instigates a coup against another. And Matt sees signs that's going to happen here sooner or later. Of course, a lot's happened since Matt wrote this in 2015, and you could look at the intervening events either as a sign that things are getting even worse or as a sign that the system has been fairly robust against novel stresses. Matt Iglesias joins us now. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
So, Matt, I guess I'd start by asking, if our system of government is so bad, how come we've made it work for 230 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think the traditional explanation for this, which I believe is correct, is that American political parties had traditionally been much less ideological than most parties around the world. And the United States had very low levels of partisan polarization. There's a lot of sort of complicated reasons for that having to do with the racial politics of the South. But, you know, you see today, you have a lot of figures, older people in American politics, like Joe Biden, very explicitly hearkening back to the good old days of the 1970s and 1980s when you had a less partisan system. I think there were a lot of problems with that system. Obviously, there were huge problems with racial segregation as a set of practices. But it meant that politics had a very individualistic character rather than a partisan and ideological character. And it's very challenging for our system to operate when the parties are expected to be advancing coherent, consistent legislative programs.
Is there value in checks and balances? I mean, what you might describe as veto points and things that inevitably create gridlock, I mean, are often talked about as features of the system rather than bugs. They're supposed to make it relatively difficult to make changes. You create a status quo bias in public policy. And so when, you know, when you have governments that can't agree on things and you have a Congress that's not doing very much, couldn't it just be the case that public policy is broadly satisfactory and that's why it's not possible to build the coalitions to change it significantly?
I mean, it's certainly possible that you could have that be the result. I just think that if you look at what's been happening in recent years in American politics, go back to when Obama was president, right? When you had sort of Republicans checking and balancing the Democratic president, the result of that wasn't that you then had some kind of high-minded compromise between the parties. What you had was a lot of unilateral executive action that Obama undertook under, you know, very intense pressure from the interest group coalition that's behind him. Then you had a lot of litigation from Republicans. You had a lot of moves to policy outcomes that were kind of weird kludges that nobody really liked. Now you've had a transition. Donald Trump is president, and you've had, if anything, an acceleration of this. You've had these really novel, I think outside the scope of what had been contemplated, uses of emergency powers to try to build walls, tariff impositions, things like that. So you're not seeing what you have, say, in Germany, right, which is a centrist grand coalition that has not embarked upon a lot of radical policy changes because it's a centrist grand coalition. What you have in America is this kind of brittle system where it's challenging to make changes through the legislative process that's intended. So instead, you get a lot of changes through executive unilateralism and an incredible reliance on the judiciary to kind of police policy outcomes.
So, Rich, this is actually very similar to critiques that I hear you raise a lot, which I think is interesting because my sense is that you like the American constitutional system and think that it's well designed. So if it's a good system, why has it broken down in the manner that Matt describes?
Well, I think it's clearly it's a stress in the system that and oftentimes is against the letter of the system and certainly the spirit of the system. And I think it's really bad. Trend. I don't think it means we're heading inevitably to a coup or some sort of violent revolution. I don't discount anything entirely anymore, but I think that's unlikely. And the hallmark of our system has actually been an amazing stability. A guy named Walter Burns, who used to write for think tank AEI, I'm going to mess up the story a little bit, was in a conference in Latin America once on constitutionalism, and someone raised his hand and said, why is this guy, Walter Burns, here talking about constitutionalism? America's only had one constitution. Brazil's had 15. So what does he know about constitutions. But we have had this ebb and flow in the strength and weaknesses of the various branches. The judiciary used to be very weak. You had even strong presidents like Andrew Jackson and Abraham Lincoln at least saying, I think Lincoln said at some point, as president, you shouldn't even propose legislation. It should all be up to Congress. But you had Andrew Jackson saying, you know, come and get me, copper, to the Supreme Court, and a couple of prominent cases, and Lincoln basically saying the same thing over habeas corpus during the war. Now the judiciary is stronger, the executive is stronger, the legislative branch is weaker. And I hope and I would think eventually the protectiveness over the powers and prerogatives of its own branch will compel the legislature to push back. But there's this kind of plasticity in the system. It's built around tensions and competing centers of power.
Liz, how much do you worry about the sort of unique nature of our system that creates so many veto points? Because, I mean, for example, when Bernie Sanders talks about his policy agenda and, you know, how would you get it implemented despite all of the problems that faced even a more modest policy agenda under Barack Obama, he says basically, well, we will have a political revolution. And it's a claim about, you know, creating a groundswell of popular support that makes it possible to get an agenda through this system. Is that really plausible? Or because I feel like I don't hear socialists talk very much about these constitutional issues, but it seems to me like they are a really severe barrier to the sort of agenda that socialists would want if they got in control of the government.
They are, and you do see some socialists like Seth Ackerman bring up these issues from time to time. It would certainly be a challenge with an executive like Bernie Sanders, and you can't just count on ramming everything through budget reconciliation, as tempting as that might be. So obviously, there's going to have to be some sort of shift at some point if we continue to see the rise of sort of popular movements that have interests that are opposed, not necessarily in a broad popular democratic way, but in a powerful way by vested interests that are already installed in government. And of course, amending the Constitution to make changes to our system easier is itself an enormously complex, difficult process. I think Seth Ackerman wrote, an amendment to the U.S. Constitution requires the consent of no less than 39 different legislatures, comprising roughly 78 separately elected chambers. So when you have to go through those kinds of hoops just to advance the popular will with policies, for example, that are polling in the vast majority, that does present a problem to me and does suggest that you will eventually see some sort of pressure point like Matt predicts.
Matt, people often point out something that I mentioned at the top of the show and that you mentioned in your piece, that basically, besides the U.S., nobody's really made this sort of system work. The only other country that's had a presidential system that's lasted over 150 years is Chile, although Chile, of course, had a breakdown of democracy a few decades ago. But I see the other examples being U.S. states. We have 50 states that essentially have their own presidential systems. Doesn't it look like those are broadly models that are working as well? It's not. I don't think we've seen. I mean, obviously there are states that have significant public policy problems, but I don't think that they are failed. And none of the states have chosen to move away from the presidential style system, which in theory they could. You could have a state that had a premier elected by the legislature rather than having a governor. Nobody's chosen to go that way.
Yeah, that's true. And I think in some ways it's a little unfortunate that we don't see more state level experimentation. At the same time, I think the reason U.S. state governments have been able to proceed is that in some ways in some ways problematically, we have moved state government away from the emotional center of American politics, right? You see, people have incredible responses to changes in who holds the White House, right? When Barack Obama was replaced by Donald Trump, that was elating to many people, and it was terrifying and saddening to many people, far beyond the sort of concrete policy type things. People, for better or worse, don't care that much about state government and state politics, which in some ways makes our federal system not really function the way it's supposed to. But on another level, I think does kind of decrease the stakes in state politics in a way that's constructive. At the same time, we have had an increasing examples of constitutional hardball in state governments, that it was, I think, Democrats in Wisconsin a few years ago kind of innovated the tactic of like running away so that you wouldn't have quorums in the state legislature. Republicans in Oregon are trying something similar. So, you know, you do see some of these pressures at the state level, but fundamentally, I think it's because we're not looking to state governments to resolve big questions.
It's funny, Rich, because it feels like the design of the system was supposed to be for the flip side of that, that part of the way that you were supposed to deal with intractable debates at the federal level was by pushing those questions down to the state so you didn't have to have federal solutions on them.
Yeah, and still, even today, when the federal system is eroded and the power of the states is eroded compared to what it used to be, that's still true. I mean, California has an incredibly wide latitude in terms of policymaking. So does Texas. So does Vermont. And that's another really good feature of our system. There are all sorts of different ways for people to be represented and to get their preferences. But the federal system is based on the idea that of squelching transient popular majorities. So if people want single-payer health care in this system and they really, really, really want it and they're determined, they will get it eventually. It'll just take some time. And I think that's a feature of our system rather than a bug.
Liz, do you buy that?
No. I mean, precisely because it means that lots of people who are sincere in their advocacy and who are full citizens of the United States doing everything they can to advocate for this majority position are going to die without ever seeing any sign of it passing, right? These constitutional battles we have can drag on for years and years. And because there are so many veto points, successful, well-liked, highly supported policies have many points at which they can be completely shut down by the opposing party just because they have vested interests who have the capability to shut them down, not because they have a popular mandate. And that's one feature of our system that, again, I think is pushing us toward a kind of tension that's unavoidable.
Is it right to characterize that specifically as a special interest action? I mean, because I think that obviously special interests that, you know, that have, you know, that have a vested interest in existing policies, certainly they do fight and certainly they have power. But I think another thing that we saw, for example, in the fight over the Affordable Care Act was that there was just a strong status quo bias among the public, that every time you tried to change something, it ended up underwater, both when you tried to create the law, it was unpopular, and then when you tried to repeal the law, that was also unpopular. And so, Liz, do you not buy at all into the idea that, you know, that the public was uncertain about the idea of an expansion of federal spending and authority in this area, that it wasn't just the insurance companies and the hospitals?
I mean, there's going to be some popular resistance, but you can stipulate any other policy in the place of single payer, right? In terms of what happens when you do have a policy that does have mass popular support, referring to that popular support as being inherently transient seems to rely on this kind of status quo bias that does arise in part from the behavior of government to shut down that popular advocacy. So essentially what you wind up with is a government that by nature of its shape and design pushes the population to a status quo bias and tends to resist the kind of channeling of democratic will that it's purportedly designed to actually empower.
But I wouldn't say anything is inherently transient. Only transient opinion is transient. But if there's a long-lasting, permanent majority in favor of single-payer health care, you will get it in this country. We've had enormous changes in this country with the system that we have. It's just a system that does have a status quo bias and wants to avoid radical yings and yangs between Barack Obama getting absolutely everything he'd want and his heart's desire when he's elected president, and then Donald Trump doing exactly the same thing the opposite way when he's president. And that you could have that in a parliamentary system, but it's not what we're built for.
What I think is interesting, though, you know, if you look at a country like the United Kingdom, or if you look at Canada, right? I mean, healthcare is a great example of this. You don't actually see the kind of wild ping-ponging that Rich was talking about there, right? That the Labour Party comes in the 1940s, it creates the National Health Service. And then that system essentially endures over time throughout a lot of partisan changes. And it, of course, gets modified, right? When conservatives come into power, they infuse that system with some of their ideas about low spending and the role of markets. But Margaret Thatcher doesn't come in and say, we're going to go to an entirely free market healthcare system, because people didn't want that. I mean, it's democratic politics, right? And elected officials are still bounded by sort of prudence and popular opinion. Big changes can happen when the elected officials think it's well supported. They don't happen when they're not well supported. Canada, even more so, you know, has had an evolution of its healthcare system over time, does not have this kind of like every 4 years they go back and forth between single payer and nobody has anything. It's actually the United States which has featured these kind of perennial sort of apocalyptic healthcare showdowns in which we're never really sort of moving toward anything in particular, but instead the outcomes are being very heavily shaped by what can happen in the budget reconciliation rules, what decisions do Supreme Court justices make about Medicaid eligibility, weird things happening in the states, right? It would be great if what our system was actually doing was producing stability or consensus or compromise on healthcare, but it's instead encouraging everyone to kind of take these big shots, and then what they wind up getting is almost, I don't want to say it's arbitrary, but it's a feature of the rules of the system rather than of what's good policy or what's really supported by the public.
I guess one question I have, Matt, is whether those showdowns over healthcare are really as apocalyptic as they're made out to be, because my sense of why it's been possible to have this bizarre sort of interstitial place where we've been on healthcare for years, where the Affordable Care Act lacks the support it would normally need in the legislature to do things like technical corrections. You have Republicans constantly talking about their desire to repeal it. You had the Supreme Court decision that led to the Medicaid expansion being over only part of the country, which has reduced the extent to which the Affordable Care Act covered people. But approximately, the law is working as it was supposed to, and through regulatory action and through the actions of private insurance companies figuring out how to work within rules that aren't structured exactly as they were supposed to be, they've been able to make the market work, and they've been able to enable a significant expansion in the number of Americans who have health insurance. I'm wondering, is the absurd political situation over healthcare only possible because the underlying policy is broadly acceptable? And if we had a true apocalypse, that would be the thing that would shake Congress into actually fixing something.
I mean, it's true that we are muddling through on healthcare, you know, fair enough. It's true in a sense, right? We've been muddling through on immigration now for a good 30 years since the Reagan era amnesty. But I don't think that these are pros of the system, right? I mean, that's the question for me, right? You could say, okay, we have these veto points, it creates tensions, it creates vulnerabilities, but the good thing about it maybe would be that, well, we have compromises, that we bring people together and we solve problems. But my point is that we're not actually doing that, right? We are having incredible amounts of gridlock in Congress, but still consequential policy change that's being driven by occasional electoral majorities. You know, the Great Recession of 2007-2008 is why the Affordable Care Act passed, because it let Democrats, you know, get big majorities in Congress. But we are not having any kind of rational consensus building or any of the things that are supposed to be the virtues of the American system. Instead, we're having increasing levels of weird sorts of freelancing and almost like fantasy land politics, because you don't have elected officials who win an election and then sort of need to take responsibility for their agenda. There can always be this whole other thing that we were going to do if we only were empowered to govern, rather than having a real empowered governing majority that needs to say, look, dismantling this healthcare system, we're not going to do it.
So we've been talking about some symmetrical concerns about the American constitutional system that can frustrate majorities that come from either side. I want to take a quick break, and I want to come back and talk about some specific complaints you often hear from Democrats who feel that the system is not only anti-majoritarian, that it is systematically biased against their side. I've been talking with Matt Iglesias of Vox, Liz Brunig of The Washington Post, and Rich Lowry of National Review. This is Left, Right, and Center. We'll be right back.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
If you're listening to our show, you're probably someone who appreciates all sides of an argument. So there's another podcast we think you should check out, Intelligence Squared US. America's leading debate series, they bring the most influential thinkers like David Brooks, Arianna Huffington, and Deepak Chopra together to debate contentious topics like free speech, the environment, and religion. It's not about soundbites and pundits, but a thoughtful, spirited competition of ideas. Find Intelligence Squared US wherever you get your podcasts. Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist of The Washington Post. We're also joined by Matt Iglesias, senior writer at Vox, for our special Independence Day show looking at the state of the American system of government. So, Matt, we've been talking about your piece that argues that the American system of government is fundamentally broken because it creates too many veto points, inherently creates gridlock, frustrates popular majorities, and makes it impossible to make policy that aligns with the popular will. And so that's a concern that you could theoretically have coming from any ideological position. But then there's also a lot of specific stuff you hear about the American system from Democrats who say that the system is biased toward Republicans because it's biased toward smaller, more rural states with more conservative populations, that in the 2016 election, the Electoral College had an advantage for Donald Trump, who was able to win without winning a plurality of the popular vote. The Senate empowers smaller states that tend to be more conservative. A combination of legislative gerrymandering and ideological sorting of voters by geography means that Republicans have an advantage in elections for the House. And so basically, you see Democrats saying, in addition to all these veto points that are created, you have all these inherent things that are going to make it impossible for us to build a legislative majority. And the sort of this defeatism, you know, well, even if Democrats win this presidential election, there's going to be a Republican majority in the Senate that will frustrate anything that they try to do. And I guess the question is, what is to be done about that if you're a Democrat? I mean, Democrats had 60 seats in the Senate as recently as 2008. So it seems to me it is apparently possible for Democrats to win legislative majorities.
I think it's important to distinguish. Is the system biased against Democrats? I'd say no, right? Democrats could simply change their policy ideas, right? They could try to win more votes from rural white people and retain equilibrium, right? It's a cynical system. Democrats and Republicans are not fixed entities. They have changed their ideologies a lot over time. The people who are structurally disadvantaged in the Senate outcome, right, are not professional politicians. They're individual citizens, right? African-Americans, Latinos, and residents of large cities are systematically underweighted in the system. Our interests are downgraded, and it is challenging for us to get our way in national politics and to have our interests adequately represented relative to the interests of rural white people. So is that fair? I think it's obviously unfair in a totally obvious way. There's almost nothing to say about it. And so instead, we try to translate this into a complaint about partisan politics in which you can say, look, Democrats should just suck it up and try to win more votes in the Dakotas. And I think, yeah, I mean, like, if you're just talking to political operatives who don't care about the substance of anything, that's the right answer. Like, suck it up and deal with the system. If you're caring about, like, fairness and the well-being of people who count morally speaking, it's an outrageous system. And it's, like, obviously outrageous. Everybody knows it's outrageous. Conservatives every once in a while, like, try to come up with fake reasons why it isn't outrageous. But, like, it just clearly
is.
That's my cue. And I don't know what there is to say about it. Like, why should people in Wyoming get a billion times more votes than people in Texas?
Rich, why should people in Wyoming get a billion times more votes than people in Texas?
Well, first of all, historically, we wouldn't have had a constitution without the compromise between big states and small states. And states are honored as quasi-sovereign entities under the Constitution. And yes, they get equal numbers of senators, big and small states, but they don't get equal numbers of members of the House. Like, California has 53 and Wyoming has one. And it's just a symptom of how important this was to the architecture of the system, that it's actually says in the Constitution that this arrangement in the Senate is unamendable. And again, it's another, as we were talking in the prior segment, it's another way to create different centers of power within the system in different ways for people to be represented. It's not as though if you're an African-American in New York, you don't have a mayor who's very concerned about your needs, you don't have a governor who's very concerned about your needs, and you don't not belong in a big state that has a big say in how the contest turns out electorally. In theory, I think I did the math once, you could win 39 states, small states, in the District of Columbia and still not win the presidency. Big states matter.
Liz, if this system is so indefensible, as Matt says, the question I have is, why is it so common? I mean, you see around the world to greater and lesser extents, you have systems that are designed to overrepresent rural areas. In the Japanese parliament, you have fewer residents in each constituency electing a member. You have a number of countries in Europe that have a house of the legislature that, like the U.S. Senate, have representation by state or by province rather than by population. A lot of countries have settled on this sort of system that take jurisdictions with smaller populations and overrepresent them. Is that just unjustified everywhere? And how did people land on that?
I mean, I think it's a sort of necessary component of liberal democracy that you have to guard against the tyranny of a majority, especially against sort of disenfranchised small populations that have limited power. The strange thing about the United States situation, especially with the Senate, where 84% of the population, I think, can be outvoted by 16% living in small states, is that these small states oftentimes are not advocating for what we would understand to be the material interests of rural people, right? They can advocate for their interests, but they're not actually being guarded against any kind of tyranny in the long run because of the way our politics plays out. So you see a system that has a vestigial purpose, or you can imagine a justified purpose for the protection of these smaller groups in rural areas. But the way that the politics actually functions is not to protect them. It's actually just to disenfranchise, as Matt points out, people who live in big cities, urban areas. And these are oftentimes people who, despite being part of a Democratic majority, are disenfranchised, whose interests are actually advocated against materially by the politics of these smaller states and rural areas. So, I mean, I think you can track a sensible reason for the existence of that kind of overrepresentative tendency, but I'm not sure that it's actually playing out in American politics that way.
Rich, is there a justification for the Electoral College system? Because I would note this isn't working the way the founders intended it to work. The idea was that it was supposed to be a truly indirect election of the president, that you would elect electors and they would get together and decide who should be president. And so we sort of accidentally ended up in this system where it's a system where you add up the popular vote in each state, assign them winner take all, and that's how you figure out who the president's going to be. Obviously, you know, the Constitution says what the rules are, and so there's path dependency here, and there are reasons to continue doing what one did in the past. But is there any independent justification for this structure of how a president is elected?
Well, the practical concerns we've talked about before, which is if you had a very close national election, you know, you'd have all over the country of Florida voting controversies like in every single locality. Now, it's obviously not something the founders contemplated. I do think it ensures there's a good in itself of having a geographically distributed coalition and having an emphasis on that, and Matt sort of pours scorn on the idea that you should give a little to try to win these states. But in my mind, it wouldn't be a terrible thing. The Democrats are a little bit more moderate on some of these cultural issues.
I'm not pouring any scorn on that idea. I want to be incredibly clear about this. Like, that is the thing that Democrats should do. But it is unfair to the residents of big cities to say that their votes, that their interests should be underrepresented. And like, there is no way in hell that if it was conservative white people whose interests were being systematically underrepresented, that we'd all be like, la-di-da, who cares?
Well, I mean, before 2016, the conventional wisdom at the Electoral College favored Democrats. And Barack Obama had a lock on the Electoral College, right? So a lot of this just seems to me, the election didn't turn out the way it was supposed to be. And what I said about Democrats maybe moderating some of cultural issues to have more appeal in these places, Donald Trump wouldn't have pierced the blue wall if he hadn't moderated on economic issues and rejected parts of Republican orthodoxy to have appeal to people living in these particular states. And I think it's a good thing.
Right. So, I think it's important to distinguish between the Electoral College and the Senate in this regard, right? These are two different things that people complain about. I think it's true that the Electoral College as recently as 2012 had a bias in favor of Democrats, and people like Donald Trump at that time were very opposed to it. The Senate is different, right? The Senate, by design, has an enduring permanent structural advantageousness to low population states, right? The Electoral College is like quirky and it's kind of fun for people who like elections. But I want to note, the Electoral College doesn't encourage geographically dispersed coalitions. It does actually the opposite, right? In theory, you could win zero votes in states that have almost half the electoral votes and then win 51% of the vote in a narrow coalition of states that gets you over the top in the Electoral College, right? So it does the opposite of encouraging you to have a geographically dispersed campaign. It lets you get away with having a very narrow campaign. And someday, you know, the wheel of politics may spin to the point where Texas is a swing state and Democrats can actually win the presidency based on some kind of New York, California, Texas, Florida, Illinois type coalition. And then conservatives are going to see, as they saw in 2012, that this is a dumb system. The Senate has a stickiness to it.
But just in defense, at least, some conservatives and the conservatives at my magazine, we defended the Electoral College when it was conventional wisdom that it was bad for Republicans. And the system is constantly in flux. And states that are now taken for granted that there will be a Republican forever, as Texas has been for a long, long time, won't be forever. But it's not a system that is biased against one party or another.
Can we talk a little bit about what, if anything, to do about any of these issues? Because, I mean, Matt, you know, you're talking about if you're a political operative, it's right to just say, suck it up and deal with this. It's still a matter of broad fairness. One concern I have about fixating on this stuff is that it encourages people to sort of adopt this view like everything about my party and my ideology is fine and I would win if only the rules were fair. And then people focus on the unfairness of the rules rather than on what to do to win within the rules as they exist. And so I guess my question is, What are the productive outputs of conversations about this unfairness? I think, you know, I think you can't change the Senate. Conceivably, there are some things you can do around districting that matter at the margins. You have people in the Democratic Party coalition who want to have this sort of weird interstate compact trying to undermine the Electoral College. Which parts of this do you think are a useful use of political energy? And do you worry at all about what I worry about, which is that it becomes a distraction for people? They don't focus on how to win because they're so focused on complaining about how unfair the rules are.
No, I agree with you 100%. I am incredibly anti-complaining. I am 100% on team suck it up and deal with it. I also, though, like, I'm not kidding around when I say that I think that there's going to be a breakdown of constitutional processes in America, and I hope that we come out of that with a better system. I think that there is a bad tendency in American politics and American media to over obsess on the personal characteristics of individual leaders and their foibles and to second guess them and to say, well, if only so-and-so had done such and such differently, like it would all be fine. I think that if we end up in a place that is not fine, that we will hopefully come out on the other side, as Rich was saying. You know, Brazil's had 15 constitutions. And if we find ourselves with another one, we should try to actually address these systematic weaknesses in a real way. Until then, yeah, like if you're a political party, you should try to win elections with the rules as they're written. You should pay attention to stuff like gerrymandering. I mean, things that are addressable inside the confines of the system. But like there is no fixing the Senate. There's no point in spending all your time on sort of having sore feelings about it. But I also do think that we shouldn't do this thing of like reifying power and pretending there are good reasons for it. I think what Rich said about the Electoral College initially was really wise. Like we have this system because it was a compromise that was needed to get the Constitution put in place hundreds of years ago. That is the reason why. It has no particular normative force, but there it is, and you got to live with it.
Liz, how do you think about these things strategically? To the extent this stuff is a barrier to your vision of how government should work, how do you think about working within the system and how do you think about trying to change the system?
I mean, it is the constitutional system is definitely a barrier to leftward goals. And I think it is that in part by design, because of who designed it and the time period they were living in and the possibilities presented to them by revolutions that were happening around the world that were a little bit scary to elites who were designing governments. So insofar as talking about the unfairness and the difficulties built into, and especially the anti-democratic measures built into our government, brings attention to the fact that there are systematic barriers to left goals, I do think that is helpful in terms of building a popular movement, as long as you don't pitch it as a defeatist point, right? That, well, nothing's ever going to change because of the way our country is designed fundamentally, so there's really no point in doing anything except sort of technocratic tinkering. I think that's the wrong pitch. I think the right pitch is to say we have to build a popular movement with a real, intense, obvious, and lasting democratic mandate, precisely because there is also a vein in our governance that does respect democracy, or at least places a high moral value on democratic mandates. So the help there is it emphasizes the need to focus on systems instead of individuals, which I think is important for any left coalition building. And it also helps to create the impetus to build a popular movement. And I think Bernie Sanders is exactly right when he says that the kinds of changes that he has in mind and that the contemporary sort of young democratic socialist left has in mind will take nothing less than a lasting, really concentrated popular movement. So I think it's useful in that regard. I also think it can have a defeatist downside if you pitch it in the wrong way.
Just on the founders, what they feared was concentrated power, and they feared it because of their extensive and accurate reading of history and how this has ended in tears and all sorts of polities all around the world. And they feared it because of the recent experience in England of the Stuart kings, who overstepped what had been the traditional bounds of monarchs in England to try to adopt more an absolutist model of royal absolutism like you saw on the continent. And America was in some sense founded in the reaction against that that push towards royal absolutism.
But Rich, isn't the counterfactual now? It's not a royal absolutist system. It's a
yeah. I am against royal absolutism.
Yeah, well, they
But I guess my question
they had
is
a civil war, and they beheaded one king. Then they went after another king, James II. And because there are all sorts of things that played into it, but they invited a monarch onto the throne, establishing parliamentary supremacy, and then all sorts of things followed in the wake of that that established practices and rights that have defined English political culture ever since. So they have a largely ceremonial monarch, and Britain works. But going back to our earlier conversation, I don't think like Latin America is a good example of anything. The presidential system failed in Latin America because these countries, a lot of them, have deeply dysfunctional political cultures and all sorts of terrible rivalries. You could have had a Westminster parliamentary system in those countries and it would have failed as well.
Matt, do you buy that?
I mean, I agree. It failed because they had these terrible rivalries, but we have them now too, right? I mean, that is my point, that America used to be special, used to be exceptional in this regard, because we did not have entrenched ideological politics characterizing our parties. Or rather, I should say, we did have a moment of entrenched ideological politics in the 1850s, and it led to a breakdown of the constitutional system, a huge war, hundreds of thousands of people died. Fortunately, the good side of that war won, so we kind of write that off as the system works kind of case. But now we have a comeback of those kind of entrenched, very ideological politics, and the system doesn't work under those conditions.
Yeah, so I guess to just bring it back full circle, I mean, Rich, the question is Canada a cautionary tale? If the alternative that, I mean, the argument essentially that Matt is making is that parliamentary systems are better, would America be giving up something important if we had a system of government that was similar to what you see in Germany and the UK and Canada?
I think this system best suited over the long term to protect our liberties. And then there's just the practical question, how are you going to affect this constitutional revolution? And three, it's an embedded part of our political culture and national identity. It defines them. There's a deep loyalty and fealty to the system. That's a good thing. Having a written constitution allows you to assert your rights vis-a-vis the government that all sorts of people from all hues, all creeds have been able to do throughout our history. And a parliamentary system, at least the Westminster system, you can't have anything. You can't have a written constitution, have anything above parliament, which is supposed to be supreme. And I just don't think that's a good system, at least not for this country.
Let's leave it there. Matt Iglesias from Vox, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Liz Brunig of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back with Michael Brendan Doherty, also of National Review, to talk about what Irish Americans can teach Ireland and America. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. Michael Brendan Doherty was raised in New Jersey and New York by a single Irish-American mother. His parents were never married, and his father lived far away in Ireland. Michael's new book is called My Father Left Me Ireland, and it's a memoir about his eventual reconnection with his father and his father's homeland. But it's also a reflection on national identity, how affinity to a place and a society gives us a sense of purpose and connection, and how that can sometimes be a better guide in policymaking and in life choices than green eyeshade wonky thinking. Michael Brendan Doherty, who's also a senior writer at National Review, joins us now. Hi, Michael.
Hi, great to be here.
Thank you for joining us. I really like your book. One thing I found interesting about it is, you know, it's this book about the importance of connecting with national identity. And the identity that you connected with is one that is not from the country where you have made your life. And so
yes.
I guess the question, you know, for me as an American who does not have sort of a readily available ancestral homeland that I have a deep familial connection with besides the United States, what are the lessons here for Americans and for America? If you have some sort of thoughts on, you know, how Ireland should reconnect with itself, what does that mean for a country as diverse as the United States?
Sure. I mean, I am also connected to America and America's traditions and am a loyal American. This was, you know, the book is written as letters to my father, so it concerns what he and I have in common. What I would say, though, is that the book shows, and I think maybe it makes it easier for Americans to see, that Ireland has sometimes a very unhappy history, and its history, its poetry, its literature, its folk song tradition all have a way of providing this sense of solidarity in times of stress, strain, or conflict. And my, you know, the kind of theory of nationalism I've been promoting is that national identity, our sense of nationality, comes out strongest under these times of stress and strain. America is in a kind of happy period of its history where we are at war around the world, but we are not at war at home. We are a prosperous, peaceful nation. And so we are able to pursue our own projects and private interests. And yet there's still this reservoir of cultural material that would draw us together when we're under stress and strain. And this book is a little bit of a project to help us remember and reconnect with it, that this is still a necessary thing in our culture and in our own lives.
A problem that often arises with national identity is it has to be exclusive in some way. It does not necessarily have to be exclusive along lines of religion or race or ethnicity, although very often it is. But it has to exclude somehow. In order for there to be an in-group, somebody has to be out of it. So what's the way to build a model of a healthy national identity that doesn't lead to ugly strife?
Well, I mean, it may lead to ugly strife because we're human, right? We are humans and conflict is kind of built into history. But a national identity, America is blessed to have one that's very capacious and that people, groups that have been excluded from full citizenship in the past are able to draw on it. That, you know, you can think of so many figures in history, Frederick Douglass or others, who have mastered the language of the founding fathers, of their nation's repository of political literature, or biblical literature, and then moved into the center of the country, moved themselves into it and appropriated it for themselves. And that is available to any one group in America. And, you know, of course, the other thing that's great about the kind of broader Western tradition is that political membership is usually tied to territory, to sharing a territory and endeavoring to live together under a shared law. And that's a huge advantage over, you know, rival systems that tie things much more directly to race or to religion.
Liz, is a sort of sense of stronger national community identity, is that a useful thing for building support for socialism? If you want people to buy into a project of wealth sharing, if you sort of have people have this idea that, you know, there's something that binds us all together, that has us all in it together, conceivably that could lead for a stronger support for a more active government as part of that social sharing.
Well, it can lead to support for lots of different things. There's no one direction that sort of national identity and an emphasis on national identity is going to run in. I think that part of what you're seeing right now in American politics is a heavier focus coming from the right on national identity. And you can sort of see the fruits of that in our political landscape at the moment. And they're not pro-socialist. You do see more of a critique, I suppose, than you have in the past coming from some segments of the right, folks like Tucker Carlson and so forth. Those don't seem very central to their actual political project. They seem more ornamental. But the actual socialist movement in the United States, sort of young democratic socialist movement, on the other hand, does not seem to rely heavily on a national identity. In fact, it kind of has internationalist overtones. There's connection between the American Young Democratic Socialist Movement and the British Democratic Socialist Movement, for example. So I think that, you know, nationalism, you can't really trust it to serve as an engine of sort of leftward social change. I think that when you look at types of solidarity that tend to underwrite socialist movement building, that's going to be based on material circumstances, material experiences of the capitalist system and class.
But so you don't think that's something missing from the left's account right now in American politics, needing to say, you know, trying to basically turn the right's position on its head and say, you know, here's an American project that we're all in together, and here's a left version of that rather than an international project.
You can see efforts in that direction. Elizabeth Warren, for example, sort of headlining her entire economic policy as economic patriotism. Seems like an effort to kind of thread that needle and say this is actually, you know, pro-American, semi-nationalist project. I'm not sure it actually invigorates the left or that it's an exciting way in terms of the left's perspective to frame those issues. And I'm not sure that it even appeals to the right. I don't think she's necessarily going to peel anyone off from Trump's movement just by saying, actually, this is economic patriotism.
I disagree with that. I think it's really shrewd on her part. I agree with Liz. Nationalism is it's an inchoate, it's a very flexible force. But because of that, it's available to anyone. And as Michael points out, it has a deep appeal to human beings, to real people. So besides libertarians, who in the extreme view kind of think of us as a collection of individuals, and cosmopolitans, who think our country of fellow citizens shouldn't have any special status vis-a-vis anyone else in the world, it's available to everyone else. And FDR used it, you know, the Blue Eagle campaign and others during the New Deal. Socialists in Sweden used it in the 20th century. You see some of it in Bernie Sanders. There was that famous exchange with Ezra Klein, the editor of the policy website Vox, where Ezra says, well, you're in favor of poor people, so why don't you let all poor people across the world come here because that'll be better for them? And Bernie says, no, that's a Koch brother idea. That's a libertarian idea. If you do that, you don't have a nation state. And I think it's bad that the Republicans lost touch a little bit during the Bush years and afterwards with nationalism. And I think it's bad for the Democrats that they've lost touch with it as well.
Michael, one thing that I thought was really interesting in your book is the way that you talk about how national identity basically gives people a reason to build and grow families. Having a sense of obligation to pass down a heritage is a reason to have children and raise children. And you almost talk about like a decommodification of parenting. I like this quote where you talk about the way sort of technocracy flows into the way that we talk about everyday parenting. You say, quote, read to your child because children who read with their parents make on average an additional $1 million over their life. Cuddled children get lower mortgage rates as adults, unquote. So I guess the question is, what is the lesson here for policymakers? Because when you see Republican politicians talking about, you know, encouraging a higher birth rate and family creation, they tend to, you know, focus on technocratic things because that's what's available to the government. And you talk about child tax credits and the marriage tax penalty and that sort of thing. What are policy lessons from this idea that you have?
Birth rates are notoriously resistant to, you know, just these little prick and pin shifts of policy. I mean, you see sometimes, you know, Mussolini instituted pronatalist policies, but it seems actually that the prospect of war was actually what was driving higher birth rates rather than the sort of fascist cult of motherhood that was built in Mussolini's Italy. And that's certainly not something I'm advocating. But on the cultural sense, I mean, the argument that I show in the book is that there's kind of this culture of liberation that leaves us feeling atomized, even though it promises liberation. And what I found in having children of my own after growing up in a fatherless home was that my children kind of connected me back to my absent father and through him, our ancestors. And in a way, like, it's our parents, our grandparents that push us forward to have children ourselves, right? So there's this kind of reverse thing where our children give us back the past and our parents, our grandparents, and our ancestors push us forward into the future. So I don't know if there's an exact policy shift, but there's definitely in America, when you see birth rates crashing below replacement level, you have to begin asking the question, and even politicians should be asking it publicly, what is this breakdown between generations doing to our country? Is it good for our society? Does it lead to a healthy society? I don't think that it does right now.
I mean, Liz, there are sort of two separate sets of justifications for pro-parenting policy. One is certain people are hoping that that will encourage people to have more children. The other is simply that it makes the lives easier of families that do have children, even if it doesn't have an incentive effect that changes the number of children that they have. Do you see a higher birth rate as a valid policy goal? And do you see that as something that the government has much ability to affect?
I mean, I don't see it as something the government necessarily has much of an ability to affect. You see similar policies in different countries having different effects, which suggests that in some places, certain policies are going to have a pronatalist effect and you're going to see a bump in birth rates. And in other places, the exact same policy is going to have a negligible effect. And I think it's very difficult to estimate ahead of time what those outcomes are going to be. So I think that setting your goal at bumping birth rates is a kind of dangerous play because you can wind up undermining very good policies in that way because you won't necessarily get the effect you're looking for, which doesn't mean there's a problem with the policy. It just means you set the wrong goal. I think that the reason that I tend to focus so much on pro-parent policies, which are really pro-children policies, is because nationally in the United States, parenthood plunges lots and lots of people into poverty. Right. So you add a non-worker who comes with expenses. And if you're a family that's sort of on the line, that's going to present a lot of challenges financially. So the reason to come out with pro-family policies is to prevent that slippage into poverty or economic insecurity that comes with the very, you know, sort of ordinary, mundane act of having a child.
I'll make a broader point. I think some of the ferment on the right at the moment, ideological ferment, has to do with a recognition that I think is overdue that as conservatives, we tend to consider the threat an overweening statism. But now we have what you might think of as a toxic individualism that is leading to, in the worst cases, deaths of despair around the country. Excuse me, where these isolated individuals who they're not married, they don't go to church, they're not involved in any civic associations, they only have attenuated connection to the workforce, and therefore their lives have no meaning. And we get our deepest, truest meaning through associations and relationships. And just thinking about how, you know, what's the economic component of that problem, what's the deeper civil society reason for that problem, and what, if anything, can we do about it is like a really, really important question.
Yeah, Michael, I mean, it seems like your book partly has a prescription to that, not necessarily a policy prescription, but a prescription for individuals in society. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how this has been received in Ireland and what you hear from Irish people about it, because it seems to me like the concept of Irish identity that you have focused on in the book and that has been so useful to you is maybe out of fashion in actually existing Ireland today.
It is out of fashion, right? I'm definitely – the book is partly a reaction to what I'm hearing coming out of Ireland, which is in a kind of post-nationalist mood even after celebrating the centennial of its great historic events like the Easter Rising. And so the book's reception there has been interesting though because in Ireland there is a pervasive sense of loss that's unarticulated. That you saw this coming up during the Celtic Tiger and then especially after their tremendous financial and economic crash in 2007-2008, which was Ireland began looking back and saying, wow, we got ahead of ourselves in this rush to prosperity. And maybe some of the traditional Irish statesmen like Éamon de Valera, who preached a frugal comfort for the country, were onto something. So that there's been a kind of opening up, at least to this book, which has been received pretty well over there, saying that, yes, there probably is something valuable in this, you know, our national history, which features so much sacrifice at its heart in an era when we have just been encouraging, you know, kind of hyper-capitalism and opening ourselves up to Anglo culture across the world. I think there is the sense in Ireland that Ireland itself should still have something to contribute that is native, part of its native genius to the world, was appealing to readers.
Let's leave it there. The book is called My Father Left Me Ireland. Michael Brendan Doherty, senior writer at National Review, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks to Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, and Matt Iglesias. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Tudum Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.